We have peace in our time. The Iran war is over. Maybe. Sort of. There's a new ceasefire at least, but the Iran regime is intact, and potentially they have a massive new revenue stream. We'll look at what all this means and more on today's Trumpet World. Welcome back to Trumpet World, where we analyze the week's news through the light of Bible prophecy. And that's a pretty unusual proposition. But this week's news shows it's a very successful proposition. The Iran war has ended, again, sort of. We'll get into that in a minute. But we're at the point where it's finished up exactly the way that we said it would from our programs right at the start of this war. Iran is a bit battered and bruised, but it is still an Islamist regime, still hating Israel, still hating America, still hating the West. And that was our Bible-based forecast. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has been saying for decades that Iran is the modern king of the South. And he's been applying that to the scripture here in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 that says, "At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him," him being the king of the north, "and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overthrow and pass over." And our free book, The King of the South, recently updated, probably now needing updating again, I guess, after this war, it explains all of this. It shows how radical Islam led by Iran is the king of the south. It proves that the king of the north is the same power described in Revelation 17 and elsewhere. It's this beast power in Europe led by the Catholic Church. The rest of Daniel 11 makes clear that this is a clash that's taking place over Jerusalem. It's a religious clash between an Islamist king of the south and a Catholic king of the north. And so based on that very simple prophecy in the Bible, we've said all along that the Iran regime would live to fight another day. And that has happened. And it's not because we're fantastic analysts at all. It's because of revealed truth from the Bible. And we had some comments here on YouTube right from the start of the Iran war saying, well, see, this proves you wrong. Donald Trump is about to completely wipe out Iran. He's about to bring in a democratic government. That prophecy has failed. And it did look like that. Certainly initially, with America's pretty awesome initial success taking out key members of the government. And it seemed hard at first to see how this regime could continue, as you had various leaders assassinated, etc. And now, though, the regime is intact. And Iran is going to continue, and they will push at the King of the North. They will push at this Catholic Holy Roman Empire, and they will be the ones that come in there and completely obliterate Iran and its regime, not the United States. Now, that doesn't mean that the story is completely over. There is a lot of tension. The ceasefire could fall apart at any moment. Even between us recording this and this show being uploaded in a few hours, there's a lot that could change. We could have, you know, Donald Trump could just start sending in the bombs again. But however that plays out, expect Iran to still be this radical Islamist power. So to give us more information about this ceasefire, about these points of tension, what it means going forwards for Iran, how even this ceasefire sets up this Daniel 11 and verse 40 prophecy to be fulfilled, I'm joined now by our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekig, and our Anglo-America correspondent, Andrew Miller. So first of all, let's go to Mihailo and get an update on what exactly was agreed this week.
Yes, Israel and the United States agreed with Iran for a cessation of hostilities on April 8th. According to U.S. President Donald Trump, this is just a two-week ceasefire to give some time to organize an actual agreement. In the meantime, all of America's assets in the Middle East are still on standby. The actual text of the ceasefire itself is a bit of a mystery, in no part because the two sides are giving two very different pictures as to what this ceasefire entails. The U.S. and Israel claim that Iran has agreed to allow shipping to pass through the Strait of Hormuz again, that this does not include the war Israel is fighting with Hezbollah in Lebanon. We'll get to that a little bit later. That there are going to be more comprehensive talks about Iran's nuclear program, etc., etc. Iran is saying that, well, Lebanon was included in the ceasefire, and also it is based off of the 10-point peace plan we gave about a week ago, which I don't believe we've covered on this program, but from what we can tell, was basically Iran saying, we'll agree to a ceasefire if you agree to withdraw all sanctions, if you give us a right to nuclear enrichment. Basically, a flat-out insult to all of America's positions, saying, we'll only stop fighting when you basically surrender and let us do whatever we want. As you can imagine, those two positions are quite irreconcilable. And because of that, the US hasn't been striking Iran, Israel hasn't been striking Iran, but all the other aspects of what we would expect from the ceasefire have not really happened. Iran immediately violated the ceasefire a few hours after it was signed by sending a barrage of missiles towards Israel. And the most crucial part, what President Trump was saying everything hinged on was the big goal, was the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has not been giving free passage to ships to sail through the first day of the ceasefire. I believe that Iran let a total of four ships go through the strait. I don't have the details for the days after that, but even those ships that could do it, that was after they were pressured to pay transit fees to Iran in the form of cryptocurrency, because cryptocurrency is a lot harder to track and sanction, as far as America is concerned. That was a huge red line of President Trump's. And even with the optimistic track record we have of him, or I should say, even with the track record we have of him being optimistic of his ceasefire deals with, say, Hamas in Israel or even Ukraine and Russia, he seems to have not given Iran the benefit of the doubt with this one and said that they've completely disregarded the terms we agreed to, and we might start bombing again very, very soon. He's made a lot of threats like this before. Right before the ceasefire, he threatened to erase Iranian civilization if they didn't agree to something, paraphrase of his words. And then they agreed to a ceasefire, and then again, Iran immediately broke it, and so far, Iranian civilization is still existing. So, a lot going on in the air, but as you mentioned, there is good reason to at least be cautious of how long this ceasefire will last.
Thanks for that, Mihailo. Maybe we can bring in Andrew for the US perspective on this ceasefire with the question that I think a lot of people are asking right now: did America win or lose?
That is a good question that definitely a lot of people are asking. It's a hard question for many news analysts to answer. We'll be able to take a more definitive answer for you here in a moment. But the reason it's hard for many people to answer is President Trump wasn't very good at defining the objectives of this military campaign. He originally came in and said, after he killed the Ayatollah, said he's like, well, we've cut off the head and the body is withering. Then he kind of pivoted to, well, our main goal is to make sure Iran doesn't get a nuclear bomb. Then he said, he's like, well, we want regime change for a while. Then he came back and said, actually, we don't want regime change, but got it accidentally. And so that is kind of the crux of why people are struggling with this question. I think you could say, if you want to look for a silver lining, in like the mowing the grass type respect, is the bombing campaign has probably delayed Iran's nuclear ambitions. It has probably also done quite a bit of damage to their missile arsenal. So the military has been weakened. There has not been regime change, and as a matter of a fact, I think they've made things worse. Before this war, Iran was definitely a clerical theocracy run by a supreme leader elected by a council of mullahs. Due to the war, the most hardline element of the Iranian government, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, has basically blackmailed the Council of Mullahs into installing a puppet ruler, Mojtaba Kemani, who may or may not be conscious and is pretty well widely considered to be a figurehead for the IRGC. So Iran, it's basically being run by the most radical elements of the previous regime. And as you alluded to earlier, I think the big loss for the United States is that before this war, ships passed freely through the Strait of Hormuz. During the war, the IRGC has basically been acting like pirates by extorting ships to pay million-dollar fees to get through the strait. And now we actually did just get our first series of Twitter posts from Mojtaba. No video, so we're not actually sure if he wrote it or if he just borrowed Joe Biden's auto pen. But these Twitter posts are saying that, like, the now going out of the war, the big goal of the Iranian government is to formalize their toll booth keeper position. So you're not just going to have the IRGC using piracy tactics to extort ships to pay them, but they're actually having the Iranian parliament pass legislation to formalize a toll. I read a foreign policy article on this pretty good yesterday saying that the Strait of Hormuz, the entire width of it, according to international law, falls either in Iranian waters or Oman waters. So they said there might have to be a bilateral agreement hammered out between Iran and Oman to figure out who gets what money. But they said basically, short of complete regime change, which is not going to happen, short of complete regime change, it's almost guaranteed that Iran comes out of this war as the main toll booth keeper for Hormuz. So this is one of those strategic sea gates that we talk about a lot in this program that God promised the descendants of Abraham. Britain ran it for decades and then lost that gate. So we've talked for many years about Hormuz already being one of the British Empire's lost sea gates. Although this new development looks like it could be even more lost, because for the past couple decades, it's kind of like no one ran it. It's just anyone could go through it. Where now, it's looking like this is going to be an Iranian sea gate with an Iranian toll. And so I think based on the fact that the regime's, the Islamic theocracy is still in place, as a matter of fact, the Islamic theocracy is even more radical, and Iran is formalizing its position as the toll booth keeper for Hormuz, you can decisively claim that America lost this war, regardless of whatever damage we did to their missiles. That's a temporary thing. Those missiles can be rebuilt as long as the regime's in play. So it's looking like this is just really an unmitigated defeat for the United States. In a way that could actually escalate Bible prophecy going forward. In his book, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, our editor-in-chief points to the fact that Daniel 11 prophecy about the king of the south pushing at the king of the north, said that push is going to revolve mainly around the city of Jerusalem, but control of the oil supply is going to be a big part of it. Even Donald Trump said yesterday that he's looking at a peace deal that would allow the U.S. and Iran to kind of share responsibility for Hormuz. No details on exactly how they'd share it, but I think the big important thing from that point is even Donald Trump's looking at the fact that, like, yes, Iran's going to walk away from this with more control over Hormuz than it had before. More control of the oil supply, which gives a huge lever to push at Europe and the Western world in a future war.
And I think massively undermines America's position as the as a global superpower. Like I wrote a bit about this impact of the, of this issue of the oil, because I think it is huge and really far reaching. Because I mean, you mentioned international law gives Iran half of the strait, or they split it with Oman, but the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, which I think you could say, as far as international trade goes, it's kind of plays the role of constitutional law. It's a very foundational law. It says that countries that border a natural choke point cannot charge tolls. They cannot restrict access in this way. Now, canals are different. Egypt is allowed to charge tolls on the Suez Canal, Panama Canal. Those are man-made. They cost more money to maintain. Turkey kind of sort of has a carve-out on this because they the Montreux Convention that was signed before the UN Convention of the Law of the Seas gives them, it guarantees free passage, but it does give them a right not to charge a toll, but to charge a fee for coast guarding and lighthouses and rescue service. And some have said it's more like a pilot fee. I mean, I think it kind of is a thinly disguised toll, but it's grandfathered into the system. But after that, no, if you have under the international law, if you're on a choke point like that, you cannot use it to, you know, to charge rent. It feels like going back to this time last week I was going down the Rhine and I was recording, or I was writing the Trumpet Morning Brief, recorded the show, my bits for the show from in front of the Rhine, and you've got all of these medieval castles that were all rebuilt in the 19th century and are completely inauthentic now. But the reason why you've got all of these castles down the Rhine is because you'd have somebody who'd sit there with their castle next to the Rhine, and to pass down the Rhine, you have to pay them a tax. And then you go a couple of miles and there's another castle and you've got to pay them a tax. And it's called rent-seeking behavior because it doesn't benefit, like you don't get anything for paying that money. It's not a, here, I give you something and I get something of value in exchange. They're just using geographic position to extort people. And one of the main, like this has been a major feature of human progress, of coming to the age where we can trade freely, is that that has disappeared. And that bit by bit, we've gotten rid of that type of rent-seeking behavior. And we have eliminated that internationally. And more than that, this is part of the foundational bargain of America's global dominance. You know, this is a core part of the agreement of America is the number one superpower. America's military dominates the world. A lot of countries do not like that. Part of the reason they don't challenge that is they don't think they can get away with it, perhaps. But part of the central bargain is, okay, fine, America dominates the world. They're the number one power, but they keep the sea lanes open. And I can have free trade all around the world, thanks to the U.S. Navy. So, okay, as a non-American, I might resent that, but I'll live with it. And if America's, if that bargain is gone, and if you start needing to rely on your own navy to protect yourself, you're going to see big military buildups. You're going to see nations challenging the United States. And this is related to the end of America's global dominance and dominance of sea gates. And certainly, you know, if we start getting rid of this principle in Iran, well, what if it spreads? What if China says, hey, we're building a new island? You know, there's a new story this week. I think Jeremiah will talk about it a little bit later. China, they're fortifying yet another island in the South China Sea. Somewhere around a third of all ocean-going trade passes through the South China Sea. What if China says, hey, we want a toll? Now, Iran's taking a toll. You've got to pay us. I mean, Britain won't do it. I think it'd be pretty funny if we did. What if we said, everyone passing through the English Channel and through the Strait of Gibraltar, if you're entering or exiting the Mediterranean, you got to pay us. We want a toll. We want a fee. It would completely undermine the era of free trade and that, you know, it's not just American global dominance, America's economic dominance, the dollar being the global reserve currency. All of this is kind of then thrown into question if America is reneging on that central bargain and saying, you know, we're going to give Iran permission to extort a fee here, and we are not keeping the sea lanes open. And, you know, you Andrew, pointed out that this goes, yeah, right in line with Daniel 11 and verse 40. I mean, he even talks about, yeah, the push against Europe. It talks about Europe coming at Iran with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. Like, there's definitely a strong naval component in Europe's response to Iran. They are You know, there are many ships. They're coming in with a vast naval armada, probably to forcibly open the Strait of Hormuz and the Red Sea and some of these other sea gates. So that alone tells you a lot about Iran's strategy. Mr. Flurry's drawn attention to the fact that as you read in along in this chapter, it talks about Libya and Ethiopia and Egypt being aligned with the King of the South, being aligned with Iran. So, I mean, these countries all share, they're all on a coastline, they're all on the Mediterranean or the Red Sea, the Suez Canal. And Mr. Flurry says, well, talked about in the King of the South booklet, well, this points to the role that these choke points, the Red Sea and the Mediterranean, are going to play in this conflict. Iran is going to weaponize those against Europe. You can absolutely see that coming out of this conflict. And even the way this conflict ended, the scriptures point to exactly this. Like Iran's strategy, it's written in these verses written down 2,500 years ago. So there's that. But then Mr. Armstrong in the United States and Britain in Prophecy has a huge amount to say about sea gates. Because Genesis 22, verse 16 to 18, God tells Abraham that, well, it says, your descendants will possess the gate of his enemies. A few chapters later, Genesis 26 and verse 40, Rebekah, Abraham's daughter-in-law, was told, be you mother of thousands of millions, and let your seed possess the gate of them which hate you. I mean, when we're talking about thousands of millions, what is a gate in that context? It's a maritime choke point. These were given exactly as you said, Andrew, to Britain, to America. And then they used them really to keep open global trade, to not charge rent, and to really encourage an era of global free trade, of global productivity. How many nations have gotten rich from this? You know, China exporting to the world, making vast amounts of wealth. And now these are being taken away. In Deuteronomy 28 and verse 52, God says that, well, he tells the recipients of these blessings, Britain and America, that if you refuse to obey him, he says, you will be besieged in all your gates. You know, those gates that God gave us are slammed shut. And we're getting a bit of a taste of that with Hormuz. Now, like I said at the start, I think there could well still be more to the story. The amount of money that Iran could get from this is obscene. So Reuters, for example, their columnist Hugo Dixon estimated that they could get $500 billion over the next 5 years. Okay, big numbers, lots of zeros. What does $500 billion mean? Iran's government spending in 2024 was just over $50 billion. So $500 billion over 5 years, you're looking at $100 billion a year. Like, this is potentially, just due to the toll fees, Iran's government spending could go from $50 billion a year to $150 billion a year. Like, they could have an extra, you know, they could triple, quadruple their military spending and have money left over just from the money from this tolls. It's such a big game changer that quite a lot of people are actually saying the Gulf states, they can't stand for this. They would not survive in the long term in a Middle East where Iran is getting that kind of income. And so they'd be forced to take action. And you know, maybe that's an indication that this push will come sooner rather than later. And you'll see Europe getting involved very quickly. But the Hormuz, it's just a massive part of this story to pay attention to. Going back to this deal, as I think Mihailo already alluded to, where it could all fall apart is on Lebanon, where Israel and America say Lebanon was not part of the ceasefire. Iran and Pakistan say Lebanon was part of the ceasefire. And Iran is saying, well, we're not going to open Hormuz and things like that. We're not going to stick to our end of the bargain until that Lebanon issue is resolved. So where are we on that, Mihailo? What does the future look like for Lebanon? And is this likely to break up the whole ceasefire?
Well, Israel is still skirmishing with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Prime Minister Netanyahu has indicated he has no intentions of backing down at this point. But the interesting wrinkle in all this is, amid all of this chaos happening, not just in Lebanon, but in the rest of the Middle East, the Lebanese government, which is separate from Hezbollah, which does not represent Hezbollah, which on paper is against Hezbollah, even though they haven't been able to do anything about it for over a year now, they've been asking for direct talks with Israel, as in government to government, official, potentially even normalizing relations. And on April 9th, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said, yes, I am authorizing these direct talks with Lebanon, and they are apparently supposed to happen next week. There is some question as to whether they'll follow through or not. One representative of Lebanon's presidential office told BBC just this morning that a ceasefire with Hezbollah has to be in place before the talks happen. Netanyahu says, no, we're going to keep hammering Hezbollah until and have the talks ongoing while we do this. So there's some question as to whether these talks would happen. But if this were to happen, I mean, technically, Israel and Lebanon have been in a state of war since 1948. They've never had relations, period. They've toyed through independent leaks in the media, through military talks about going this way before, but this looks like, at the very least, the most serious, at least from the Israeli side, offer we've seen on this point. The details of the talks are that each country's respective ambassador to the United States would speak with each other in Washington, overseen by the United States.
And then another aspect of this, I think, is the way that Europe is putting the pressure on Israel. And you can see, even from what you were talking about a couple of weeks ago, the kind of potential divide between Donald Trump and Israel. I mean, you could see how in the eyes of the world, Israel could very quickly become the bad guy here. We've got this deal with Iran. The hang-up is that Israel keeps bombing Lebanon. And of course, left out of that will be the fact that you've got a maniacal terrorist group in Lebanon that will use any latitude you give them to try and kill Israelis. And the world will potentially blame Israel for the unseating of this, or you get pressure from Donald Trump on Israel to sign a deal. And you're already getting that pressure from Europe, where the German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, he said the severity with which Israel is waging war there could cause the peace process as a whole to fail. That must not be allowed to happen. And you know, this is from Germany, the European power Israel considers its strongest ally. Emmanuel Macron, he said, I express France's full solidarity in the face of indiscriminate strikes carried out by Israel and Lebanon today, which resulted in a very high number of civilian casualties. And those statements, I don't think that's true. Israel doesn't carry out indiscriminate strikes. And from all of the statistics that we've seen in their previous wars, they've been astonishingly effective at avoiding civilian casualties, particularly when they're fighting terrorist groups that want to cause civilian casualties. So he's there spreading fake news. You're having the European Commission president or the European, basically Europe's equivalent, the EU's equivalent of a foreign minister, also putting pressure on Israel to sign a peace deal. So we're seeing Europe getting more involved, particularly in Lebanon. And you know, we saw Europe being very determined to get involved in Cyprus. Now we're seeing Europe very determined to get more involved in Lebanon. These are key parts of, again, it's talked about in The King of the South, the alliance of nations that we've been saying for years that Europe would build up in the Middle East. And that's due to a prophecy in Psalm 83 that fits hand in glove with Daniel 11. And then again, this book talks about that you would have Europe as they work to counter Iran and then work to get control of Jerusalem for themselves, or they form a network of allies among Middle East states that are on Iran's enemy list. And you can definitely see if Iran is then charging tolls on the Strait of Hormuz or however, Saudi Arabia, many of these countries looking to Europe and Lebanon and Cyprus, they're already there and very close to Europe and these European powers. Thank you for that, Mihailo. Anything, Andrew, from this war that it's still worth considering or from your region as a whole?
One of the things I'm watching really closely right now is the economic fallout, particularly with the treasury bonds. I've made this point on this program a few weeks ago that America for the past like 50 years has had an informal deal where they defend these strategic waterways in Saudi Arabia and the other oil producing countries in the Organization of Petroleum Exporters. buy U.S. Treasury bonds. So when the strait was cut down, the Treasury bond yield spiked pretty high. Now that they've come up with a ceasefire, it's come back down. But I do think one thing that's important to keep an eye on is if the Saudi Arabians and the other Gulf states feel like America's unwilling or unable to defend these straits, they may start looking not only for another protector, but another investment. And this could have long-term repercussions on the dollar's status as the reserve currency. In terms of other news stories in the Anglo-American region that I have one from Britain that's kind of still related to this war, and then two other ones from America. The British one is just really highlighting how far their power's fallen. It's like they were the power that actually secured the Strait of Hormuz in the last century. So now, not only has there been a major rift between Donald Trump and Keir Starmer over the British Prime Minister not sending ships to Hormuz, really the only British military deployment in this whole war was one ship to a British military base in Cyprus, the HMS Dragon, which was delayed for several weeks and then actually had to go straight into port for technical difficulties and repairs once it got there. Which is a story, I think, that just does highlight the fact that America's at the stage in prophecy where God is breaking the pride of their power. Even though they have tremendous power to deal with crises like this, they no longer have the will to use it. Britain, with this one ship they sent to Cyprus that needed repaired as soon as it got there, is actually, I think, at the stage where there's actual power that they use. It's not even so much the pride in their power at this point as their actual power of the British Empire has been broken. Then two other stories. One, here's some bad news in the United States just about the birth rates. Our birth rates have fallen to a new all-time low, about 53 babies per 1,000 women of childbearing age. Number of reasons experts are putting out for that. One, cost of living's high. People are prioritizing their careers. People just don't want kids. But definitely some long-term societal implications from that, as it's getting to the point where America's workforce, if you don't count illegal immigrants, is no longer growing. You're not actually producing enough children to replace the current workforce, or just barely producing enough children to replace the current workforce, which, since our entire social security system's based on the math that it takes four full-time workers to support one retiree, means that that declining birth rate's gonna have some long-term economic repercussions for America as well. And then one final quick story about something that used to be big news and kind of people have forgotten about with the COVID pandemic. Remember back during the COVID pandemic, you had companies around the world forcing people to get vaccinated, whether we want to or not. I have several friends who lost jobs because they refused to get vaccinated. Well, now, we're coming a couple years out, we're getting some studies that people are trying to sweep under the rug, where Scientific Reports just did a study analyzing 500,000 teenagers from Norway and finding that their risk of heart inflammation went up fivefold, or 500%, if you got the mRNA vaccine, showing that it wasn't what they said it was, just a safe way to get us through the COVID pandemic, but we're having millions of people worldwide who still have health problems due to taking that vaccine that governments tried to force on the world back during the COVID pandemic. And we had a lot to say about that back then, and now a lot of the science reports coming out are proving that we were right on the money from the very beginning with that particular medical technology.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. The topic of sea gates has come up already with Iran wanting to charge a toll for everyone using the Strait of Hormuz, but China is taking some important steps forward to getting more control over the South China Sea, one of Asia's most important maritime passageways. To get the latest on this, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. The big story for Asia that I wanted to talk about is that China is advancing its colonization of the South China Sea by turning yet another submerged reef into an island, a heavily militarized island base. So this is a story that has really been in development since back in 2013 or so. That's when the Chinese Communist Party first started dispatching crews out to reefs in disputed parts of the South China Sea. And they would use dredgers to pump sand up from the seafloor and onto the high parts of the reefs. And then they would pave over it with cement and then bring in weapons and start to build barracks for soldiers and basically transform what had been a wholly or partially submerged reef into a sizable artificial island hosting military bases. In the 2010s, China did this at 7 different locations in the South China Sea. And at the same time, they were also building more and more military outposts on normal natural islands in the area. And it was all for the purpose of enabling the Chinese Communist Party to assert dominance over the South China Sea, this tremendously important maritime region that so much of global shipping flows through. And the activities seemed to have kind of tapered down over the last several years without a lot to report. But now the Chinese are doing it again. They've spent the last several months at a place called Antelope Reef in the Paracel Islands. So far, they've reclaimed almost 1,500 acres at Antelope Reef just since September or October of last year. And on top of all that new land, they've built jetties, piers, a helipad, and numerous gray-roofed buildings, and also what appears to be the foundation of a military-grade runway. And they're also dredging out a lagoon that appears capable of berthing submarines and warships, possibly even including warships as large as aircraft carriers. So a very sizable area there. And as all of this construction presses ahead with unmistakable military intent, many analysts are saying that Antelope Reef could soon become China's largest island base in this region. So it's quite a significant development, quite sobering to look at the satellite imagery and see just the breakneck speed of China's construction there. And it is going to help the Chinese Communist Party be even more assertive and even more aggressive about trying to establish dominance over some of the most important shipping lanes in the world. And this is something that Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has called attention to over the years. He has said that China's militarization of these islands and its slow takeover of this region should, quote, alarm the world, because it means China is steering the world toward war. In our July 2016 print issue, he wrote a feature article by that title. It's called China is Steering the World Toward War. And one part of this article says, these militarized islands now function as forward bases for Beijing to challenge 7 decades of American naval dominance in the Pacific Rim. This should alarm the world. End quote. Mr. Flurry's article from there explains that all of this very provocative Chinese activity will soon play a part in fulfilling a Bible prophecy about modern-day America and Britain actually being besieged by China and some of its partners. Deuteronomy 28:52 talks about this future besiegement. It says, and he shall besiege you in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down, wherein you trusted throughout all your land. And Mr. Flurry says China's militarization of the South China Sea is one of many areas where onlookers today can already see this prophecy moving toward its fulfillment. So it is very significant and very alarming, I think, because it's leading to a time when China will be able to control 1/3 of the world's maritime commerce through this vital region, and the U.S. and its partners will be blocked out. So if anyone would like to understand more about China's land reclamation and militarization and what it means for America and Britain and why these developments mean everything is headed in the direction of war, I hope that you'll read Mr. Fleury's article on this topic. Once again, it's called China is Steering the World Toward War.
Thanks for that, Jeremiah. And I think, yeah, it is. We've lived in the last couple of hundred years, really, of being in this time where free trade, like, and trade over the oceans is open. You know, Britannia ruled the waves, and then they passed the baton on to the United States. And both of these powers, like I mentioned earlier, used the control of the oceans and of these naval choke points generally to just allow everyone to trade freely. And it's led to a huge amount of prosperity. And yes, you know, some of that is imbalanced and has been taken advantage over by some powers more than others. But in general, it's unlocked an era of a huge amount of prosperity for the whole globe. And I think a lot of people that are unconcerned about what they see happening in China and the South China Sea, they just kind of assume, okay, well, Britain guaranteed free trade for everybody, America. All right, well, if China takes on a lot of power, well, we're just still going to have more of the same, right? That they're going to just guarantee free trade for everybody. And I think what we see with Iran, where they're not close to being in the same league as China, but they've got their little Seagate and they're like, well, nope, we want to start charging you tolls. You know, this is a bit of a glimpse at what a world looks like where different powers control world trade. And so China getting control of the South China Sea, like this is not a kind of an academic theoretical threat. This is something they could use to make the world a lot poorer while enriching themselves, but then potentially to, like you're kind of highlighting at the end there, well, besiege, to starve nations into submission, to use it as a weapon of war. And this idea of just, well, the oceans are open for trade, it's been that way for generations, but that's not some kind of mystical default. So an important story to keep watching for sure. What else did you have for us from Asia?
Yes, just one other story here about China opening a dialogue with the main Taiwanese opposition party, the Kuomintang. This was on Tuesday that the chairperson for the Kuomintang arrived in China for a six-day visit at the invitation of Chinese ruler Xi Jinping. Xi Jinping has been eager to meet with this politician and to build deeper ties with the Kuomintang because he knows that this party is far more pro-China than other Taiwanese parties. The other main parties, including the party that's currently ruling Taiwan, they say that the Taiwanese need to buy all the military equipment that they can. They need to draw as close to the U.S. as they can and to Japan and Australia and others so that they can deter a Chinese military invasion or be ready to fight if the invasion happens. But the Kuomintang are different. They adamantly oppose any sort of military conflict with China, and they instead favor engaging in dialogue and just engaging in every way with the Chinese Communist Party. They do stop short of saying that Taiwan should just peacefully surrender to China, but really when you extrapolate their policies out, that's basically where they would end up. So of course that's music to the ears of Xi Jinping and other Chinese Communist Party leaders. They would love to accomplish their goal of conquering Taiwan without having to go to the trouble of invading and losing a lot of men and spending all the treasure to do that. So that's why Xi Jinping invited the Kuomintang's leader to China. And even though the Kuomintang have not ruled Taiwan for many years, they do remain a potent political force in the nation, especially since more and more Taiwanese are beginning to question whether or not the United States would really keep its promise to protect them in the event of a Chinese invasion. And this is something that we keep a very close eye on at the Trumpet, because we've said for more than 25 years now that America's broken will is going to be the main factor that will enable China to conquer Taiwan, whether that's through capitulation by the Taiwanese or through war.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. An important part of the world to not lose sight on while Iran has dominated the headlines for the last month. Well, that is about it for Trumpet World today. I'll just conclude back where I start with recommending our book, The King of the South. This forecast exactly how the war in Iran would end. It was right. Yeah, Mr. Flurry was right with his book based on Bible prophecy. Dig into this book to find out what comes next. It's got a proven track record. And it will show you how the events in Iran and beyond tie into Bible prophecy and what you need to do about it. So you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can order your own free print copy that you can study alongside your Bible. You know, don't just believe what's in here blindly. Study it with your Bible. Prove it for yourself. And you can read it online as well. But that will show you what's coming up for the Middle East and for Jerusalem and for this absolutely critical area and even for what God's plan is behind world events. So again, you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much to all of our panelists. Thank you to Mr. Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. We will be back with our review of our latest Trumpet print edition, more Iran content as we sit down with Trumpet Assistant Managing Editor Philip Nice on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.